This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. This episode kicks off a new series about the candidates for the 2013 ALA elections. This episode features the two candidates for ALA president, Courtney Young and Barbara Imroth. I wanted to do this series so you could be more informed about the candidates for office in ALA. Don't forget to vote, which begins at 9 a.m. Central on March 19th, and ballots close at midnight on April 26th. You'll be voting by email, so if you haven't gotten an email confirmation, make sure to check with ALA. First up is Courtney Young. Courtney, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I am currently the head librarian at Penn State's Greater Allegheny campus, which means that I'm very much a frontline librarian doing reference, instruction, collection development, also managing the budget and staff and working with faculty and administrators on campus. My MLS is from Simmons College in Boston, and I have a bachelor's degree in English with minors in women's studies and black studies from the College of Worcester in Ohio.
And why do you want to be ALA president?
That's always a great question and one that I'm very happy to answer. There are a number of reasons why I would like to be the next president of the American Library Association. As I sort of mentioned in my introduction, I am a frontline librarian, so I know and understand, you know, on a firsthand basis what's going on in libraries. And as a librarian, you know, currently engaged in the work that we do and often focus on as an association. And I think it's probably been a little while since we've had a frontline librarian as president of the association. And I think there's a lot of value to having someone who's very much engaged and involved in the work who represents the association. I'm also a very much an engaged member of the association who understands what's currently going on. I was a member of the ALA Executive Board from 2009 to 2012. I'm currently a member of ALA Council. I've served on the budget analysis and review committee from 2010 to 2012. So I have an understanding and a sense of the ALA budget and finances and some of the changes and new approaches to revenue and our budget. That's incredibly important for all of the work that we do, I think, in libraries and obviously the country as a whole. I'm incredibly energetic and enthusiastic, and that's something I think I would bring to the position. I also have a understanding of the perspective, particularly of new or newer members of the association. I've been a member of ALA since 2002, so I have 11 continuous years, according to my ALA membership card. And so that's definitely a newer and, by some people's perspectives, younger perspective of the association. And as a past president of the New Members Roundtable, I think that I am really understand and am engaged with emerging librarians who are early in their career, who are, you know, still not quite at the midpoint of their career. And that's a perspective I think that's incredibly important for our association looking ahead. You know, I also want the opportunity to learn more about the association and share that knowledge with our members. It's a very complex organization. And as someone who works at a very complex organization that is one university geographically dispersed, I have a unique appreciation and understanding for working in a complex organization. And the fact that, you know, one of the things that I know I will learn from this role is that there is a lot about ALA that I don't know. I think every president really goes into it with that perspective. But there's an opportunity to chip away at that and to know more and to make connections. And I really want to move our association forward and really highlight the value of ALA membership. And, you know, my approach to doing that looks at things with regards to diversity, career development, and engagement and outreach. I had the opportunity, obviously, during the midwinter meeting, in addition to the presidential candidate forum, was to visit with, turns out I went to 35 different meetings for either division board meetings or roundtable board meetings or committee meetings, even some socials, to talk to people about my candidacy. And I really want to focus on the value of membership because I think that that's something that is really in the forefront of members' minds. And it's something I think that is incredibly important and that ALA could do a better job of demonstrating not only, you know, the value of ALA, obviously, to our users or the public, but also the value of ALA to those of us who have a passion for libraries and the work that is done, the engagement that takes place in libraries. So that's really what I want to focus on, because I do think that membership in ALA is valuable. I've gained a lot of value from it as a member, and really want to be able to highlight the fact that we do have some great things that we're doing, but there's certainly more work that we can do. And if we can improve and sort of build on the foundation that we have in sort of the three key areas that I've identified, diversity, career development, engagement, and outreach, that I think we can do more to be an even stronger association.
What can you say to librarians who are considering not joining ALA because of the financial commitment?
Well, it's something that I certainly understand. I mean, I earned my MLS in 98, and I think I was a student member briefly, but then was not a member for that sort of first 5 years until I got involved in 2002. And I was a member of the Michigan Library Association, because that's where most of that time I was working in Michigan. And so I certainly understand and appreciate the fact that there are reasons why, you know, any member, quite honestly, would potentially not join ALA. I think it's incredibly valuable. You know, one of the many things that I've been able to gain and appreciate about my membership are the people who are involved and the network of colleagues and friends that I've been able to grow as a result of my involvement in the association. I mean, ALA does really great work with regards to advocacy and intellectual freedom, those sort of frontline things that people think about. And sometimes there can be a perspective of, well, that's, you know, ALA is really focused on this type of library or this type of librarian. But it really does help all of us. The work that ALA does helps all of us who are not only librarians, but library school students, retired librarians, our trustees who are members, you know, our advocates and our users. But there's also that component, you know, of having that network of people who you can call upon and contact when you have a question, when you're not sure how to approach a situation, that network becomes incredibly important. And I think I very much value the fact that nowadays we have social media that really allows those connections and contacts to not only grow even faster, but it means that you are able to connect with those people at a much faster rate than you were before. And so I really think that having that network of colleagues to, you know, not just be social with, but also to have those career development opportunities. I appreciate being able to observe, for example, conversations on Twitter with librarians who are talking about implementing some new service or program. And I get that, and there's a real value add there, I think. And a lot of those connections for me initially really are facilitated through my involvement with the association. And I really feel that, you know, there are certainly, you know, are decisions that you have to make with regards to, you know, is membership too expensive? You know, if I could just join this piece of the association. But there really is a lot of value, I think, that we gain as members versus not being members. It's really, I think, important to remember that joining a professional association is your commitment to your own professional development. It's a commitment to, you know, what you have decided to do in the profession. It's a commitment to libraries, because we have to remember that there aren't just librarians who are joining our association. We have support staff who are members. We have a whole division that's devoted to, you know, boards and trustees, United for Libraries. And so, you know, we have a lot of people who value this association and what it does. And I think that if you can be a part of that, then that helps. I do believe that the association needs to potentially make some shifts and expand in certain ways the opportunities for participation and engagement. And you're seeing more and more of that, I think, for example, with the virtual town halls and the, you know, there's going to be a virtual meeting later this month, or should say February, for library school students that'll include the president-elect. And so I think ALA recognizes that, but having more of those opportunities, I think, will increase the value seen by potential members and joining the association.
So a lot of what you were saying kind of ties back to what you were saying earlier, is that the way to show it to people of the financial commitment is to show them what the benefits are.
Yes.
Another related question that sort of came up recently on Twitter, and somebody actually asked me before to ask you and Barbara both, is that we should change the name of the organization to American Librarian Association to emphasize the people rather than the buildings. I know we have, as it was brought up, that we have the APA. What do you think about that? That some people think that there's too much of an emphasis on library than there is on librarian.
I think it's an interesting question, and it does, it points to two things. It points to one, sort of that need, or the fact that there needs to be some work and advocacy and an association around the profession. But it also points to the fact that the knowledge and understanding, the existence of ALA APA is not very broad. I think that probably beyond people who are serving on ALA APA committees or who are members of ALA Council, which also make up the ALA APA Council, there probably is not a whole lot of knowledge or visibility of ALA APA. And I hope it's okay if I kind of talk to this in a couple of different pieces.
Sure.
I think that the piece about renaming the association to ALA APA or to the American Librarians Association, there's some real challenges, I think, in doing that, because as I mentioned before, this is not an association that is solely made up of librarians. We have, you know, library school students who you could argue are, you know, sort of the future librarians or, you know, potential librarians. But we have library support staff, and some of whom have absolutely no interest in becoming librarians and are very happy in the role and the work that they do in libraries and have a passion for libraries. We have, as I mentioned, you know, trustees, for example, who, you know, are not necessarily working in libraries or librarians, but they have an appreciation and passion for libraries and the role that the libraries play in their communities. We have a significant, you know, vendor community who are members of our association, some of whom are librarians, but some of who are not, and they're members. And I think that, you know, changing it, you know, to a librarians association potentially alienates us from those other folks who are very passionate about the work that we do, the role that we play in our communities. And that community can be, obviously, can be either your, you know, neighborhood community where you live. It could be, as in my case, of the work I do on a day-to-day basis, the college campus where I work. So we certainly wouldn't want to do that, but it does really say, we know we really need to look at what we're doing with the ALA APA. And, you know, ALA APA, And I know that Barbara was a member of council when this was created. So she's going to be able to, she'll be able to speak a bit more about that creation process, because I don't believe I was involved in the association at that time. But ALA-APA, you know, was created to be that organization that advocates for librarians and higher salaries. One of the challenges with ALA-APA is money. ALA made a loan to ALA-APA so that it could be established. There was a sense that there would be more donations and funding available to allow ALA-APA to pay off their loan as well as do more. But that has not necessarily been the case. The position, the director, the previous director for ALA-APA, that position went from being sort of 100% to 50% time, and that, and then now it's, you know, 25% time. We have someone who's the director for ALA's Office of Human Development Recruitment Retention, HRDR, who is 25% of her time is as the director of ALA-APA. So it's kind of challenging because you can only get so much done when you have very few resources and someone who only 25% of the hat they wear is committed to that piece of the association. So also the focus of APA with regards to the ALA-APA Council has also shrunk. I first went on the ALA Council in 2005 as the New Members Roundtable rep to Council. And at that time, ALA-APA, in terms of its standing Council meeting, I think was allotted for about an hour and a half. As of the that time has decreased, so now the ALA-APA meeting that just took place in Seattle at midwinter was, you know, allotted for 30 minutes. So those things say something is going on here, but clearly based on the conversations that that I got to just sort of see and kind of was paying attention to on Twitter, that potentially there really is a need for something like ALA-APA, but, you know, is ALA-APA the organization that needs to exist? Does it need to exist in another form? What should it be doing? What could it be doing? I'm actually a member of an APA committee, the fundraising committee, and we had the event at midwinter, but you know there are definitely some challenges there with regards to, you know, the mission of that group, the resources that are available, you know, and what I'm sorry.
I was going to say like you and then Jenny Levine also chimed in that there's legal issues between the two organizations too that you can't necessarily just all of a sudden switch and say, oh, we're going to do this, because you not can't really.
Right. And the one of the things that's important to remember is the tax status component with regards to the work that ALA versus ALA-APA could do is critical and key, and that's why different organization was formed. ALA is a 501c3 organization with regards to, you know, its exemptions and tax status. ALA-APA is a 501c6 and is described as, and I'm reading from it's the actual organization description, as quote unquote, a nonprofit professional organization established to promote the mutual professional interests of librarians and other libraries. And it's focused on certification of individuals and specializations beyond the initial professional degree and direct support of comparable worth and pay equity initiatives and other activities designed to improve salaries and status of librarians and other library workers. And so, you know, those distinctions in terms of what ALA-APA can do versus what ALA can do is incredibly important in that distinction. Whether or not the executive board of ALA needs to put a more critical eye to ALA-APA beyond just the financial component may be something that is important and then adds to that sort of value of membership that I'm thinking about.
What else do you think that ALA could do to partner with other sort of sister organizations like the SLA?
This was an interesting question because ALA does have some affiliations with some organizations like SAA, Society of American Archivists. It was interesting because I did a little bit of research because I am a reference librarian. Will be. And it was interesting to because I have a very limited knowledge of SLA, but I do know a number of librarians who are members and who are involved in SLA. One of the things that I found was interesting, and with SLA in particular, is that in 1949 SLA disaffiliated from ALA. So obviously there was that really early connection, but then it really became its own distinct separate organization back in 1949. One of the things that I also found interesting in looking at SLA's mission and ALA's mission is that they're very, very, very different with regards to focus. Now, with SLA, their mission, vision, and core value statements, which were revised and adopted in October 2003, notes that special librarians are information resource experts who collect, analyze, evaluate, package, and disseminate information to facilitate accurate decision-making in corporate, academic, and government settings. Now, certainly, there is some overlap in terms of ALA with regard to those settings, because we obviously do have librarians who work in corporate, academic, and government settings. Obviously, the school library, public library, trustees and affiliates component is not within the scope of SLA. So that's sort of one obvious gap as well. And SLA is very much a global organization. I do know and had the opportunity back in December to speak with Brent Mai, who's now the past president of SLA. SLA has a very different global landscape with a different type of complexity. But I know that he talked a lot about focuses on leadership, which is certainly, I think, something that intersects with ALA. ALA also has we're very privileged to have the current New Members Roundtable president, Janelle Kinlaw, who's also an SLA member, and she works at NPR, so it makes sense that she would be involved in SLA, but also she's very much involved in ALA, and she said that she stayed involved in the American Library Association after she graduated from library school, because she found that there were more opportunities for her to be involved within ALA. And then, she noted that her particular division that she's been involved in SLA, which is the news division, has been dwindling. But she says that her local chapter really has allowed her to be more engaged and has been a lot more relevant to the work that she does. I think there could be some career development opportunities, but I think that there, one of the challenges with speaking of SLA in particular might be some gaps in terms of, I guess more so focusing on the overlap in terms of the folks that are involved in that work that SLA covers as well as ALA. But I think that ALA does tend to be pretty good in terms of partnerships with organizations that make a lot of sense. And you know, with that, like I said, with SLA, I really have a very limited knowledge and understanding as to why, you know, obviously there was there's a history there. But I do think that in this time, these times of sort of competing funds and competing, resources, also with regards to time, being involved, very involved versus just being a member and one versus the other, that could be challenging.
Right.
But I think, you know, I think that the ALA is always very open to collaborations and opportunities and really focusing on staying, mission focused. And I think that, you know, points where the missions very much dovetail are where you have the opportunities to really play to your strengths. But, you know, they're very different organizations, but I don't know whether or not there appears to be or there could be more synergy or communication or really where each organization is with regards to certain issues. It's a really interesting question, and I appreciated the opportunity to think about it and really talk to the folks who I know are involved in both. And, what they see in their perspectives.
And sort of in a related question to the previous question of, you know, should we change the name of the organization? I've talked to a lot of people on this show about people have different ideas about what you call the people who use a library. Do you call them patron or customer or user or member? Do you have a preference and do you think it matters or is that just semantics?
Don't personally have a preference, and it can be semantics. I do think that, you know, in a lot of ways there's a, you know, knowing your audience and knowing, you know, in what location it makes the most sense to refer to people. I prefer to be able to call people by names, quite honestly. I'm certainly happy when my patrons or users or students, you know, want to refer to me as the librarian or hey library lady or, you know, what have you. But a lot of that has to do with, I think, where you are. Obviously, when I'm talking about the people who use my library, I'm often referring to them as students or faculty or staff or, you know, community borrowers. But, there seems to be ebb and flow with regards to whether or not we call them patrons or we call them users or, we call them community members or what have you. I'm all about making connections and getting to know people and being able to, refer to people by name or, you know, connect with them in some way. And I think that libraries do a good job of knowing who the people who walk in and out of our doors or who are connecting with us virtually or online, who they are. And, I think that it's, I don't know that it matters. There may be some new terminology, their new word. You know, I know that some people really don't like using the word customer, but other places they are referred to as customers. But it's, I think the fact that we have no agreement on, you know, how we decide to refer to the people who use our libraries, and keeping in mind that we're also talking about ourselves, because those of us who work in libraries are probably also very big time library users in their own communities or at their own libraries. So, I think it's a lot of it also we have to remind ourselves that, you know, it's that whole sort of, you know, do unto others as you want others to do unto you. You know, how do you want to be referred to? How do you want someone to think of you or address you or speak to you? So I think sometimes we forget to remind ourselves that, that we need to be inclusive in terms of the language that we use, because it's not a, it's often, sometimes it can come off as an us versus them. I think that is never the intention. But I do think that there are times when we need to be thoughtful about the fact that, you know, we're talking about ourselves as well when we're using that language or when we're having these conversations.
Right. And it always feels to me like it's a very librarian-y kind of thing to do, that we have to categorize and classify everything and we have to have the exact name right.
Yeah, exactly. We want to be able to identify, you know, we want to be able to identify people so that we can identify what they want and identify what their needs are you know, what will make them happy. It comes from the best place possible, but it can also be the thing that kind of creates these gaps, as it were, and you know, ways to bridge those gaps that we create just based on, you know, what we, like you said, are trained to do and how we are, you know, taught to think about, you know, information and user needs and, you know, customer service. And
so, aside from what we call them, how do you think librarians can work more with our communities to meet their needs?
I actually feel that libraries do quite a bit, and that's one of the things that, one of the great things that motivates us to do the work that we do. I think we're very engaged in our communities, no matter what that looks like. We're very focused on the needs of the folks who walk in and out of our doors, or who, you know, we're as someone who staffs our library's virtual reference service, you know, for a long time, I've been thinking about, you know, how do we, you know, do a better job providing access to the student or the graduate student or the faculty member who isn't going to go to the library on their campus. They're going to be accessing it from their office or from off campus, or if they're doing research in some other part of the country on a sabbatical or something like that. And I think that we really need to give ourselves more credit for the fact that we're doing those things. There was, I think, an article in the most recent American Libraries. I know that I read it or saw links to it online about a librarian in California who suddenly was doing these clinics for you know, for people who are going through foreclosure, and or, you know, the housing bust that kind of took place in 2008. And that to me is an excellent example of someone who recognized coming new into a position that, you know, there is this need in the community. And, you know, it's not the kind of need that you obviously would actively think about, or, you know, it's a bittersweet sort of thing to know that there's suddenly this housing crisis and you need to, you know, do something to support your community by putting together these clinics. And that to me is sort of a perfect example of how libraries do a fantastic job of recognizing their communities, you know, recognizing what's going on and how to support your community during a housing crisis. It really doesn't get more community focused than that. And so I think that to me is a most recent shining example of how I think libraries do a good job. You know, I think libraries also have worked very hard to pay attention to trends and have materials and resources available for their users, patrons. Now I'm very self-conscious about how I refer to with the opportunity to experience using, you know, a Kindle or an iPad or, you know, a device that lets you determine how much electricity you're truly using. You know, and at the same time, recognizing that sort of some of the tried and true things are also continue to be important. We continue to acquire, you know, print books in our libraries and probably will for a long time. And that's okay. And that's good. So I think that sort of recognition that not everyone's going to want to sort of jump on every trend, but there are people who are going to want to jump on trends, and we'll provide that and have that available. You know, another thing that coincided with sort of, you know, these financial challenges that we've had in the country over the past several years, you know, had to do with jobs and layouts. And libraries were there in order to provide people with connections to the internet, because there still is a digital divide, provide people with assistance and workshops for putting together their resumes, you know, interviewing skills, that sort of thing, you know, setting up email addresses. So I really think that, you know, we should continue to do those things that we do well. We should continue to pay attention to trends and spot those trends. We need to continue to create access in all the various ways that happens, whether it be, you know, having books on the shelf, having audiobooks available, you know, having great spaces for teens to, you know, geek out, having access to, you know, ebooks. You know, I think that we need to keep, libraries have always done really dynamic things. And I think we just need to keep doing those things. We're still continuing to push the envelope with regards to, you know, the things that I do in academic libraries. You know, I think that we have also done a good job of really sort of meeting our users and providing them, you know, continuing to be engaged and providing them with services and resources by, you know, combining more and collaborating more with other offices and services on our campuses, you know, being embedded in courses, that sort of thing. So I think that really we're doing it. Probably what we need to do maybe is come up with more ways to really advertise it and highlight it more outside of the library community. And I know that the ALA is certainly thinking about ways to get some of our messages and some of the things that we do out beyond the library bubble, for lack of a better term. But I think that there are things that we can do to better demonstrate to people who don't speak our sort of library language the value of the things that we are doing. Because I think a lot of it has to do with sort of discovery, that people find out that, oh, your library does X. Your library provides access to Y, and that people just don't realize how much we're doing and how much is going on.
Right. I always say that was one of the original sort of concepts of why I wanted to do this podcast in the first place, because I was hoping I know 99% of the people who listen to it are already librarians, but I kind of wanted people who weren't librarians to be able to listen to it and see what cool things that librarians are doing. And so you can see, well, we're not just sitting around reading books, not just sitting around shelving books. There's lots of innovative things going on in the world, and here they are.
Yeah, and we're great people who are in their communities just the same way that other people in other professions who do other things day to day are in their communities and, you know, contributing to that.
So why are you a librarian in just the general sense? What made you want to be a librarian, and what makes you continue to want to be a librarian?
I have only worked in libraries. My first job when I was 15 years old was shelving books at the Bates branch of the St. Louis Public Library. And I enjoyed that work. And because I also had I guess, a proficiency with technology. I think I use it effectively. I think I always have used it effectively. It doesn't scare me. And got to do some other things in the library in addition to shelf books. You know, I got to also check out books to people. We had one computer in the library that obviously was, you know, this is pre-internet, of course. And I remember that it still had 5 1/4-inch discs that it read, and helping people to load up the limited software that we had, which included things like Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego and Print Shop. I sort of became the go-to person for if anybody came in and wanted to use the computer that we had. But that was my first job working in the public library. And then when I went to college, all 4 years, I worked in my college library with increasing responsibilities. And my sophomore year, I decided, I sat with a friend and said, about halfway through our sophomore year, and I think it was in February, I remember it very distinctly, and I said, you know, I think maybe I should be a librarian. And I told my mother this, who was a faculty member at the college. And I remember her being so very excited. You know, she was like, you'll be able to find a job. You'll be able to, you know, you'll do great stuff. She really was really excited about it. And that was nice to have her excitement. And then I told the librarians in my college library, and they were very excited. And so, you know, suddenly I had these mentors who, you know, talked to me about library schools and, you know, served as my references and, you know, gave me some opportunities and a little bit of pre-education. And then I went to library school, and really, so I've only worked in libraries, and the things that really, you know, excite me about the work that I do and keep me engaged and passionate, are the people that I get to work with, you know, who I often do get the opportunity to get to know my name, or recognize enough, or recognize me enough that we can, you know, if we see each other across campus or something, or someplace outside the library, we can say hello and have a conversation. Having the light bulb go off when working with undergraduates, when helping them on their research projects, helping them to develop their research topics, and getting them to think about ways to fold in the materials that they find, the scholarly articles that they identify, you know, when a website is appropriate for what they're doing in their project, you know, ways to fold in multimedia, if they're doing a scholarly storytelling project, really having the opportunity for that light bulb to go off and for them to understand that that we're sort of going down this path together, learning together, and that I'm there with them in that journey. It's a lot of fun, and I thoroughly enjoy working with students, you know, in this sort of combined reference and instruction sort of sphere. And so, you know, that's the stuff that really makes me passionate about the work that I do, the opportunity to work with students who come back later, you know, a few weeks later or in the next semester and say that, you know, that they did well on the assignment that I helped them with, or that they come back. Say, okay, now I have to do a paper in this class. Or even when they graduate and they come back and visit the campus and, you know, they're happy to see me and there's someone that, you know, they want to talk to when they're here. You know, knowing that you really have made that difference with students and sort of opening their eyes and getting them to think differently about, you know, what I do as a librarian and my role on campus. And, you know, the students often, you know, sometimes they'll say, well, you know, wow, you seem to know everything. And I say, well, no, I don't know everything. I certainly wish I did, but that's what I like about my job, is that I learn something new every single day. Every one of those students, you know, teaches me something. They allow me to improve the work that I do. And this also includes the people who I work with through our virtual reference service as well, because they'll come in to our chat and have a question with something. And, you know, being able to walk someone through that and work through and figure out how to identify the information they need or how to get them around a problem that they're having, and really sort of help them move forward. Those are really good connections, because that's what it's about. It's, you know, the same as with ALA. It's about making those connections. It's about, you know, making those differences. You know, it's about, you know, being a student or a member of the association, you know, opportunity for them to be heard and understood and, you know, figure out how you can make something better, how you can improve a situation, you know, how you can get to a point where that light bulb goes out and, you know, it's been meaningful and helpful. And so I really do enjoy what I do. I spoke, my older brother, over the holidays and told him that I was running for ALA president. And he said to me, he was like, you know, it's really great that, you know, this librarian thing is really, really working well for you. And that's really exciting. And, you know, and that recognition from him that, you know, that I really did make a, you know, this decision that, you know, 15 years later is still, you know, an exciting and amazing decision for me to have made. And, you know, really having that, you know, him be proud of the fact that, you know, I took this path and it just, you know, and I really made a lot out of it. And so I'm really appreciative of the opportunities that I have to work with the students that I work with, to work with the members in the association that I work with. It's a lot of fun, and I'm, you know, excited to continue doing it as president.
So how can people learn more about you and your candidacy online?
Well, people can certainly, and I encourage them to visit my website for the campaign, which is CourtneyYoung.org. They can also follow me on Twitter, find me at Library Courtney. You can also find me on Facebook at Library Courtney as well. And if you're using Google+, the at Library Courtney also will lead you to me in that way. So I'm very, very engaged and connected in social media. You'll see me tweeting about things with regards to my library, reference service, information literacy, virtual reference, but also things that are just sort of, you know, personal to me in general. I'm a big NFL fan, so that season is now over, but certainly during the football season, I play fantasy football, and so you'll see me tweeting here and there about various games and players, and, you know, I'm also a avid baker, so you'll see pictures of things that I've baked as well. But, you know, I have a lot of things that I love to do, but they all really do come back to librarianship, because it's researching and finding information about fantasy football players that I choose to select, or identifying a new recipe to bake or, you know, cook or something like that.
Well, if people vote for Courtney, she will make you a cake. All right, Courtney, thanks a lot for talking to me, and good luck in the campaign.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye. And up next is Barbara Imroth. Barbara, thank you for being on the show.
Well, it's lovely to be invited. Thank you. I feel like it's an enormous honor and privilege to be able to be a candidate for an ALA office like this. It's been just a growth experience for me. I'm learning so many things every day, and it's really a lot of fun, too.
Well, what made you want to be ALA president in the first place?
As I said, it was an honor to be invited. I had been invited several times previously, and because of other obligations and responsibilities that I had, I hadn't said yes. And finally, I've come to the point where I thought that maybe this would be the year to give it a try. I have been a longtime member of ALA, and it's been very significant in my career development. I got my master's degree as soon as I got my bachelor's degree, partly because I was a liberal arts major at Brown University. Well, at that time, Pembroke College was a women's college, and in Brown, but we had all our classes there. And so my dad said, Barb, I was that generation, what are you going to do if your husband dies? So I thought, well, I've been working in the Brown Library for my senior year, and Louis Vagianos, who was the AD there at the time, really recruited me to go to library school. So at that time, I applied to several library schools, and I was admitted, and I chose the University of Denver for financial reasons. Some of the people listening may be interested in that because, you know, it's nice to get a GRA and not have to pay all your tuition, just work it out in the library. So I went to the University of Denver in Denver, Colorado, and got my master's degree there. And I've been involved in libraries ever since. So pretty much my entire life, I have been, well, starting out when I was a very little child, because my mother was a lifetime library user. I was writing an article several years ago, and I asked her if she knew, if she remembered the librarian that she had had when she was a child. She grew up in New Jersey, and right away she told me she was 85, and she remembered the name of the woman who had been her librarian when she was a child, which I thought was pretty amazing. But so from the time that I was old enough to, you know, take downstairs to the library in Caldwell, New Jersey, which is where we lived at the time, for story time, I've been going to the library, so pre-K or before. And then the other part of it was my father was an electrical engineer, and so anytime I would ask a question about a word or where a place was or anything, he'd say, look it up in the dictionary or look it up in the atlas. So I think I was kind of like bound to be a librarian, because between the loving children's literature and loving reading and stories and being able to look up things from an early age, because my father insisted that we look things up and, you know the definitions and spellings and even the car manual. He said, well, if all else fails, look it up in the manual. So I've been doing that all my life. But when I actually became a member of ALA, it has just been a wonderful, wonderful career development. It's opened up the world to me, literally. When I was president of the Association for Library Service to Children, I got invited to go on an IREX exchange to the Soviet Union when they were going through perestroika, and that was fabulous. We got to go to Moscow and see the foreign language library and travel around. We went to Kiev and saw the beautiful, beautiful children's libraries there, and I've served on the as an ALA delegate to the IFLA school, the school library and learning resource centers section, and then I've served on the children and young adult section too. So in total, I've served for 16 years as a section member representing ALA in two different sections of IFLA, and which means that I've traveled to 16 different countries for 16 different conferences, and that's opened up the world a whole lot too. And then a lot of other things that I have done just have given me insights into things that I probably never would have had the opportunity to do otherwise. And so I feel like working with my students, I've tried to get them involved. I always, as a faculty advisor for our student chapter, I always try to get a student to staff to go and have the new students learn what ALA is like and come back and spread that around with the other students. And so I've just had a whole lot of opportunities over the years in ALA, and I, you know, would love to share that, because I think a professional association and having that really strong collective voice for the profession is very, very important. And I think I have, over the years, gained a lot of experience and really a breadth of knowledge about the association. So I feel like I'm in a good place to be articulate about ALA and the value of libraries to our democratic society. And I'm just really excited about the opportunity to maybe become president of ALA.
Okay, well,
why do you think that librarians should join ALA? What benefits do you think it offers to members, to people who are maybe considering not joining because of the financial commitment? What would you say to those people?
That is an excellent question, and it is so interesting that students last night at the virtual town hall that Maureen Sullivan and Barbara Stripling were giving in our student chapter here at Texas had viewed that, and they answered the question. Actually, Maureen Sullivan said that was advice that she was given as a new librarian and a student and just going out into the job market. And somebody told her to join the professional association. And she said it's the best investment that she has made in her career because, again, it gives you that broader horizon. It gives you that collective voice. It gives you the opportunity to do things that you as an individual probably never would have the opportunity to do. It prods you into doing things that you might not otherwise have done, too. I mean, I've done a lot of the business ends and been on budget committees and divisions and the Texas Library Association, a chapter of ALA, and kinds of things that I probably wouldn't have been able to hear financial planners talking about building up the endowments for the association and the units and other opportunities like that. I wouldn't have had the opportunity like I've had to be on the Freedom to Read Foundation and talk with people who are at the tops of publishing and attorneys, and that my daily life doesn't necessarily involve those people, but when you're a member of ALA and you're part of the organization, it just gives you a really big range of opportunities to try out new ideas and expand your horizons.
Well, I had put out a call for questions from people to ask you and Courtney for this interview. And one of the things that came up was people said there was a suggestion and there was a conversation on Twitter about this, but that we change the organization's name to the American Librarian Association rather than American Library Association to emphasize the people. And part of that is then of course ALA APA came into the conversation that there's sort of that takes care of that. But can you talk about that a little bit of how the organization can emphasize librarians more, the people?
Well, of course, libraries wouldn't exist without librarians, but I think that's been a problem for a long time, even in writing, because you don't write necessarily, you write about the people, the actors, rather than the institution. And so which word do you use? But I think that ALA, and I know Texas Library Association right now is doing it. They have the member of the month on the homepage of the association. And so that gives people an opportunity to feature different people, and actually it's a big enough organization that you can't know several thousand people, so that it's nice to see somebody different every month, and sometimes you know them and sometimes you'd like to meet them and that kind of thing. So I'm not sure that it would be worth it to go through the name change. One of my fields is school libraries, and we've been through a lot of different, like, learning resource names, teacher librarian. Some people would go to the mat for the name change, but then it seems over the years that it changes again and again. And so I can understand wanting to promote individuals and highlight what people are doing. And I think there are a lot of opportunities to do that without actually going through a name change and having to explain it. On the other hand, I'm part of a school that used to be the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, and now we're the School of Information. And we have to explain it all the time. People say, everybody has information. What gives you the right to just use that title? So, I mean, I've been doing a lot of explaining over the years, and I'm not sure that I think we should highlight the great things that people are doing, but I'm not sure I want to spend the rest of my life explaining the name change, if you know what I mean.
Right. And sort of in a related question, I've had conversations on with other people before about if there's a preference of what we call people who use libraries, patrons, customers, users, members, Do you think that's basically kind of a semantics issue, or do you think it really would matter what we would call the people who use libraries?
I know different kinds of libraries use different words to explain that again. And my feeling is that, you know, I'm pretty tolerant about that. If people are more comfortable with calling people, the people that come in patrons or users or clients, that's fine with me. In the line of work that I've been doing most of the time, a lot of times our users are called students. And so, you know, in school libraries and public libraries, students, and also in the university, a lot of the people that use the library are students. So there are a lot of different terms for it, but I'm not sure, again, that it would be worth the time and effort to have to pick just one term. I think if like a library board or a group of people want to use one term or the other, I think different like divisions tend to kind of line up under one term or the other. But I don't know. I feel like I'm a pretty tolerant person, and I'll go with whatever, try to figure it out if I don't know already what that term is, and use the one that people prefer.
And What do you think that ALA could do more to partner with sister organizations like SLA that are, with SLA in particular, used to be affiliated with ALA and now is not? What could we do more to work with them?
You mean with other library associations?
Right.
Or because I was wondering, too, about, you know, other collaborations, and like Maureen and Barbara were talking about having a lot of different collaborations with a lot of different groups in the community. But one example that I know about, because as I said, I've been pretty active and gone to a lot of IFLAs, is that there's always a U.S. caucus at IFLA, and that's shared with six other organizations: the Medical Library Association, the Special Library Association, ALIS, the Educators, I put myself on the spot because I can't remember all six of them, but ALA is one of them too. And I think, again, making those connections where there are mutual interests is probably really important. One of the things that ALIS does is the management from ALIS is housed within the Medical Library Association, because they already have a great management team and ALIS is small, so that it's really cost effective. They get better because they have people that are working in similar kinds of organizations, and so that I think that that's a really good arrangement. And I think if ALA looks for commonalities with the law librarians. That was another one. And I know one time I went up to Dallas and I spoke to the law librarians about, because I've done intellectual freedom things quite a bit too. And it's been my understanding, and I talk to people, and like I have friends who are records managers here, even in the school doc, students who are archivists and that kind of thing. And some of the problems are really different, but a lot of the problems aren't as different as we'd like to make them be. So just look for some of those commonalities and go with where you can have good connections and good intersections that way.
And how do you think librarians can work more, not just with other organizations, but with our communities to meet their needs?
Well, of course, I'm in an institution where you're supposed to be doing research. And over the years, I've done some research. And I think going and asking the people that you're serving, the people that, for instance, who are the taxpayers or the like here at the university, what the students need and that kind of thing, and see what, you know, just really go and ask them. Sometimes that, just like I told you earlier about the young man that came to our student meeting, and we were having our bake sale soon, and I said, you know, can you bake? Would you like to contribute? And turned out his brother was a pastry chef. So ask, and, you know, it shall be opened unto you. Just find out, do a little research, do a survey, whatever it takes to find out what what is important in that community and then try to serve it. We have a town that's not too far away from here where they have a wonderful public library. It's called Georgetown, and they have a Sun City near Georgetown and everything. But the librarian up there is very creative. And one of the things that they have for checkout there is a whole set of baking pans in different shapes. So if you have a birthday and you want to have a train cake or something like that, you don't have to go and spend $39 to buy a train cake pan. You can go to the library and check it out and make your cake and then take it back and somebody else can make a train. So just even things like that. Some libraries have toys, or, you know, there are all kinds of programming. We're really lucky in Austin that we're getting a new public library and going with the idea of having more meeting spaces for people to meet for discussions. Here at the university, of course, we have lots of things digitally accessible, but lots of times during the year, you can hardly find a seat in our library because the students are there. They're there partly to study. They're partly to do their, you know, assignments and things like that, but it's partly a community building place too. There's a coffee shop outside where they can get coffee, and they can go into the commons area, which is wonderfully big and has a lot of chairs and tables, and drink their coffee and talk to other students. And so library as place, as a gathering place, I think it's really important too.
Yeah, and as you said, there are different ways that we can, you know, work with our communities, but we can work with other libraries. Like you said, you're learning this stuff from this public library and you're an academic library. So, I mean, it's different kinds of libraries can learn from each other as well.
Exactly, right. In Texas Library Association, we're divided into districts, and of course ALA has state chapters, and so we work together with different kinds. That's one of the things I like about Texas Library Association, because the school librarians haven't broken off in Texas and have their own association. I know a lot of places that's the case. And so there's state associations for primarily the public and academic librarians, and then the school people have their own, which is fine. But in Texas, we all work together, and then we can all have pay for a lobbyist that works with us, and we can have one platform to do our lobbying for whatever we want for the state libraries at the legislature, and we don't have to try to combine because we're already combined. So that, I think it cuts down some on expenses that way too, to not have those separate kinds of things. I know that doesn't always work out everywhere, but it seems to work out pretty well here.
How do you think libraries can maintain their relevance in the modern world? What is it about libraries sort of at their core that, because a lot of people will say, you know, oh, it's, you're just a big warehouse of books or whatever. And that's obviously, we know that's not what we are, but what do we do to maintain our relevance and let people know, I guess, that we're relevant?
That's one thing that I think is very exciting about what's going on at ALA right now in terms of this concept of transformation of libraries, of re-imaging, rethinking what a library is and what a library can do. And I think that we in the profession need to get that, you know, kind of hashed out, which to a large extent probably a lot of us are. All the digital repository concepts and the ebook concepts, and when we get all of those ideas worked out, and the problem solved with those, that we can go on, because libraries have always been about ideas and storing ideas, whether it's on a clay tablet or papyrus leaves or whatever we store things on, skins. I mean, I've seen, like even in IFLA, I've seen women that have scarves that they have stories on, and when they want to tell the kids a story, they take off their scarf and spread it out. So we don't do that too much here, but we do tell kids stories. So those basic functions of information are the same, no matter if we get it on our iPad or our computer, or we go and get the print copy, which I know is getting not as common as I used to be. So, yeah, I think that ALA is doing a great job of trying to lead the way in doing the transforming and the reimagining and carrying that out for the 21st century.
And you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier about how you became a librarian in the first place, but what is it kind of about the profession that keeps you excited about being a librarian? Like, why do you feel in your heart sort of why you're a librarian and why you love being a librarian?
Well, because I think I'm a lifetime learner. And as I said, I started out, if you look on my blog, there's a picture that my father took of me when I was a preschooler that, reading Raggedy Ann, just sitting there. And unfortunately, I had to wear glasses when I was very little. So there I am with my glasses and reading my Raggedy Ann at a very early age. And I still love to read, and I still love to find things out. And I love my students. I'm always learning new things and sharing them and trying to help other people learn things and find out the solutions to their problems. And so I think it's just a very exciting place to be. And I feel very fortunate every day I come to work and I think, well, I wonder what I'm going to learn today. You never know from one day to the next, because it may be a big surprise. Grabbing a quick lunch in our little eating place right before we started this, and one of my young colleagues came through, and he had a young man with him, and he introduced me. This is a writer for Wired, and he wanted to see the school, and he's writing about it. So I thought that was really interesting. I never actually met a Wired writer before, but that was good. And so I told him, because this semester I'm supervising 32 capstone experiences for master's students that they're finishing up in May, these students, and so they have to do a special project. And I have to have a few classes for them too, because I have to do e-portfolios, and we're supposed to kind of get acquainted across different fields. And so I'm having next week we have an entrepreneur who is resident here this year, and his name is Gary Hoover. And one of the things that he has done is he started a company called Bookstop, which sold books, and I think was a predecessor of Half Price Book. I'm not sure. But anyway, he made a lot of money doing that. And then he went on and he has Hoover's business reference and other kinds of reference, and that's in Austin. So he's here, and I was talking to him one day. He was asking me, because he didn't know what I did, and I said, well, I primarily like to do youth services, and I think the younger you get the kids, the better off you are. And, you know, they're going to be readers and be literate and be lifelong learners and all that kind of thing. And he said, I couldn't agree with you more, Barbara. This is great. He really was enthusiastic, and he said, I feel the same way about entrepreneurs. If you don't get them by the time they're in junior high, it's too late to get them. So I invited him to come to the class, and he's going to talk about entrepreneurial skills that our students should be taking out and using in their first professional jobs. So I told this young writer from, I was telling this young writer from Wired magazine about that, and he said, oh, can I come? I said, sure, you're welcome to come. But, you know, when I went to eat my little bite before, I had no idea that was going to happen. So as I said, I'm in a very exciting place, and I love it, and I learn things from my students all the time, and life is good. So being a librarian is a great career.
It sounds like you're going to have a lot more, maybe more guests in your class than actual students if you keep inviting people.
Well, I mean, I didn't go out of my way to do this.
It just pops up.
I already have 32 students, so that's pretty good.
So is there any, what's kind of going to be like the big theme of your presidency? Like what issues are you going to want to push?
Okay. Well, because I think that when you're an ALA president, you're in a long stream of people, and you have to realize that you go in and you're the president-elect for a year, and then you're the president, and then you're the past president, and you've got to go with what's the hot issue of the day, and you don't have very long, and you have to continue what's already been going on. And so I think that, you know, that looking for the opportunities to advance libraries is really good. But what I chose for my little, I don't know, it's on my blog. I have these little cards. I have advocating for libraries because I think you asked me initially, you know, like what more can we do to explain what libraries are now? And I think that that's a really important theme right now, that people have to know that you can't look it all up on the internet. There's too much stuff out there. Somebody has to be kind of a guide or a helper and gather that for, especially for kids, but for everybody to find things and everything. And then, the other part is empowering communities, because I think if libraries can empower communities to win them over as supporters, and the communities can speak for libraries, that that's going to be much healthier for libraries, to have the whole community be behind them and really want them, and want them for gathering places and for helping find information and finding solutions to problems in the community. So those are the two things that I'm really looking forward to being maybe a spokesperson with this collective voice of ALA that I said, what we can't do alone, we can do together when we are, you know, all working together for these goals for libraries. We have a much better chance of achieving that.
So you talked a little bit about your blog. Can you tell people how else they can find out about you online?
Well, I have a Facebook page that is Barbara Imroth for ALA President-elect. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on my blog, which is through the iSchool.utexas.edu, and I think it's connected with the ALA candidate form. And if you look me up, you'll find lots of entries because I've been active for years. As I said, I've been a chapter president, president of Texas Library Association. I've been president of the Association for Library Service to Children, and I have, you know, just been out there. And so it's not very hard to Google me and probably find out things that I would maybe even, you know, I don't even know are there about me. So thank you for asking.
All right. Thank you very much for talking to me, Barbara. And I hope people have heard this and have learned more about you and the other interview with this episode with Courtney, and can make a balanced, informed decision. And I think above all, everybody that I've talked to for this has agreed, please just go vote, because we do not like the numbers being so low.
My pleasure, Steve. I really enjoyed it, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think, you know, I'd love to have people look at the qualifications of each of the candidates and see what our experience is, and, you know, what we already know that would be very, you know, helpful in making that decision. And as you know, I have one of my friends has a West Texas story that she's made a video of, what you don't know, how what you know don't know can hurt you, which is really fun. Elizabeth Polk, and that's on my blog too. So for those who like stories, go look at that and please vote. Thank you very much for inviting me.
All right. Bye-bye, Barbara.
Bye-bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com, or you can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas, or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.